Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com, a gathering place for people who love movies. Sign up for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Maddie Robinson. This week, a show devoted to Minnesota's two favorite sons. I'm assuming that would be me and Walter Mondale.
Make that Minnesota's favorite cinematic sons, Maddie, Joel, and Ethan Coen. In honor of their latest film, we'll share our top five Coen brothers scenes and play my conversation with one of the movie's stars, Josh Brolin.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, and music from Alejandro Escovedo. But first, our review of No Country for Old Men.
Willin, what's in the satchel?
It's full of money.
He's just a guy who happened to find that money.
I got a bad feeling, Llewellyn.
It's a mess, ain't it, Sheriff?
If it ain't, it'll do till the mess gets here.
I'm looking for Llewellyn Moss.
You go up to his trailer?
Yes.
You know me, Mr. Kempinar. I take any opportunity I can to relate things to baseball. So, in taking a look at the filmography of the two best filmmakers ever to come out of St. Louis Park, Minnesota, Joel and Ethan Coen, there were a couple things that struck me. In baseball, after a dynastic run by a team, there's usually what's called a rebuilding period. Now, imagine your first eight films are Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, Barton Fink, Hudsucker Proxy, Fargo, Big Lebowski, and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
I'm imagining that
right now.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's
please,
great.
In your mind. Now, seriously, I mean, that's pretty much, what, a 1927 Yankees lineup?
Sure.
That's a dynasty. Now, what followed was The Man Who Wasn't There and Intolerable Cruelty. Now, for the most part, generally regarded as solid films, but also agreed upon as not the same caliber. Called them the late 1970s Kansas City Royals. Then, in 2004, I personally believe they hit their nadir with The Lady Killers. Call it the Coens version of the 1998 Tampa Bay Devil Rays. Now they're back with No Country for Old Men, an adaptation of the Cormac McCarthy novel, which finds the Coen brothers returning to their wheelhouse of themes, a briefcase full of money, botched robberies, and scores of memorable characters. Adam, please humor me here. Has the franchise righted itself? Are we looking at the 1996 Yankees here and a return to glory?
We definitely are. I mean, I'm a huge Coen brothers fan as well, and I like all of those films you mentioned. Maybe the only film in there that I would say, as you suggested, isn't really up to snuff with their other films, of course, Intolerable Cruelty. And I actually didn't even see The Lady Killers. Mm. So for a huge Coen Brothers fan, that gives you some idea of how little I was interested in that film. And I do obviously want to check it out. But this is my new favorite Coen Brothers film, and it's also my new favorite film of the year so far. I've seen it twice now, just as you have. And just like any great film, I enjoyed it even more the second time around. As a film, a dark, funny, incredibly well-made thriller, but I also took away a lot more in terms of some of the themes the Coen brothers are dealing with and have dealt with since Blood Simple in the 80s. And there's, of course, the obvious stuff you touched on it about greed and circumstances spiraling out of control. But there's the more philosophical stuff about the plight of modern man that I do find really interesting, and they really touch on this especially in The Man Who Wasn't There, which I think is more of an interesting film than maybe a great film, but there's a great point in that film at the end where the lawyer argues that Billy Bob Thornton's character is modern man, only guilty of, quote, living in a world that had no place for him. This film, No Country for Old Men, is filled with characters who the world has no place for, and Tommy Lee Jones, for example, his character as the sheriff here, he's the sheriff who is at his end in terms of trying to understand the rules of the world. He's totally given up. And Javier Bardem's Chigurh is the embodiment, I think, of that exasperation that he has. He's this mythological, almost Grim Reaper-like figure who his very existence makes order and civility implausible. Tommy Lee Jones, his opening narration in the film includes a line where he says something like, he doesn't want to meet something he doesn't understand. And I love that line, and that's what Chigurh embodies. So it's all very heavy stuff, including a really provocative, metaphysical second-to-last scene, and I'll be sifting through all of it the third, fourth, and tenth times I see this film, but I can't wait to do it. And the fact is, even if you choose to overlook all of this stuff I'm mentioning, there's still the writing, the acting, the editing, Roger Deakins' cinematography, all of which are just masterful.
You're right. It's pretty much a haunting masterpiece. Mm-hmm. It is one of my favorite films of the year, and it's funny because someone was asking me what they should go see, and I said, well, No Country for Old Men when it opens on Friday. And they said, oh, the Tommy Lee Jones movie. And I almost for a second said no. And then I caught myself. Oh, yeah, that's right. Tommy Lee Jones is in it. But that's not even the performance that comes to mind first. I think back, you and I have talked about how I really believe the 1970s is the acme of cinema. And I think this must be what people felt like when they saw The Godfather for the first time, when they saw Taxi Driver for the first time. Sitting in the theater, there are so many moments in this film where you sit there and you go, oh, no way. They did not just do
right.
that. Or you laugh in recognition. I really think when the Coen brothers do what they do really well, they're better than anybody out there. And they are just so wonderful at their narrative structure here. They give the audience just enough information and then disseminate it throughout the film. They trust the audience. They respect the audience and they respect themselves as raconteurs. And there's one shot of Josh Brolin who is fantastic in this film. Absolutely fantastic. He's gone to the site of this shootout. The film opens basically with Josh Brolin stumbling upon this shootout, a drug deal gone bad, and there's all these dead Mexican criminals. And he's come back to the site that night. And as he gets there, he notices there's something different about the site where he was earlier. So the camera turns, and it focuses in on his truck about 3 football fields away. Mm-hmm. And we as an audience now are right there with him. We're going, okay, can I make it back to that truck? What if something happens? And then, of course, something does happen.
Yes.
And there are so many moments like that throughout this film. The point of view work in this film is meticulous.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And actually, the first time we meet Josh Brolin's character, he's looking through the binoculars, yeah. and we see that point of view. And so the movie really does work on that level and use that point of view aspect a lot really effectively. And I love how you said that there are just a lot of moments that make you just get excited.
Yeah.
And there really isn't a more articulate way I can put that. But for me, the scene that I think is a microcosm of the whole film and what makes it so great is the scene that follows up the one you were just touching on. And it's the dog scene.
Oh, yeah.
It's this moment where he's gone back to the scene of the crime. And then, yes, some guys show up and are chasing him in a truck and they send a dog after him. And he runs into the river to evade these guys and the dog, but of course the dog follows him into the water and is trailing behind him with his little head out.
It's amazing.
It is.
Because not only is it hilarious, but it's also completely plausible.
That's exactly right. It's the whole sequence is bizarre. It's funny. You can't help but laugh at this dog with his head out of the water, but it's also menacing and it just seems wholly original, like something you've never seen before. It's absurd and, of course, exquisitely shot, though not in a way that draws attention to itself.
Nope.
I mean, if you sit back and think about what they had to do in terms of a crane and Roger Deakins and a bridge in order to shoot this over the water, you can think about it on that level, but the fact is, it's just brilliant and it isn't forcing you to recognize how it was shot.
No, exactly. And there is shot after shot, and I don't know how they get these performances out of these people, but Javier Bardem makes Hannibal Lecter look like Lawrence Welk.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy is so unsettling every single second he's on screen. And I'm the kind of person, I don't really like scary movies because if I know something is going to pop out at me, I can't concentrate on the film. So that's why I'm actually really happy that I saw this film twice. And we should point out, this is a gruesome film at the beginning. It's absolutely grisly. But what I love is that towards the end of the film, they don't focus on the grisliness of it. In fact, people meet their demise off screen.
Yeah.
I just love it. I just love being in their hands in this film.
I agree. There's actually a point where you expect Bardem to kill someone, and actually you know that he does, but it is off screen. And I remember feeling the first time I saw this film that at that point, I don't know if I can watch another grisly killing.
Yeah.
And then sure enough, what happens? It's off screen.
Exactly.
It's like the Coen brothers knew exactly when to say enough was enough. And also the way they deal with the violence, I'll never forget that. My father-in-law, when he saw Fargo for the first time after I raved about it, he didn't really like it. And one of the things that put him off about it was the senselessness of the violence. He didn't like, for example, watching the scene where Steve Buscemi takes out a gun for no reason and just cold-bloodedly shoots a cop in the head. And of course, I tried to explain to him, that's the whole point. I mean, for the Coen brothers, that is violence. It's totally senseless. That's what they're all about. And they aren't really taking pleasure in it, I don't think. They're showing it the way it is, where they're not glorifying violence by making it clean. It's random, it's ugly, it's messy.
Right.
And that's the way it is in this film as well. So I really like the way they deal with violence here. And you're right, the tone throughout the whole film is just so perfect. And I think a big part of it is the absence of a soundtrack. Carter Burwell is here, and he gets score credits, but there are maybe only one or two parts. I think when you watched it again, you noticed two scenes that you can really discern as music, but they don't even really seem like music. It's
no,
more
just small
ambient
little
sound.
Swells under a couple decision-making scenes.
Yeah, and that absence of sound combined with the great landscape shots that we get and the sparseness of the writing.
Oh,
there's
the landscape
a lot of silence
character
here.
In
it
this
is.
Film.
It really is. And the characters act more than they speak, which draws you in on this sensory level where you just start clinging to every parcel of information. I mean, every grunt or smile or sigh becomes amplified.
Exactly. And, you know, this time I noticed that there's a scene between the clerk and Javier Bardem pretty early on. And I noticed watching it the second time that he doesn't enter into a conversation until the clerk asks him where he's from.
Right.
I completely missed that the first time. There is a method to his madness.
Yes, there is.
Even if there doesn't seem to be. And that's what I love it. The Coen brothers aren't hitting you over the head here. Yes, you feel bereft at the end of this film. You are not going to feel good at the end of this film. But I do love the fact the way that they distribute the information here, they don't hit you over the head with anything.
No, they don't. And I have actually heard in talking to even a couple people, and I know there are a couple reviews out there at this point, that suggest that maybe the ending is ineffective. And it seems like some people want there to be this resolution. And if you expect there to be any kind of resolution to this film, then you're watching the wrong movie, I think.
Exactly, because you do get the sense, and we haven't really talked about the plot so much, but basically Josh Brolin's antelope hunter comes across this satchel of money, and Javier Bardem
wants it back.
And you see the toll that this money takes on both men. You see there's this wonderful scenes of people fixing themselves, of digging shrapnel out of their arm. And you see the toll that it takes on every single character in this film. No one is immune from what transpires here. And the one thing that I would say, well, the reason I don't think it's better than Fargo is that I think that Fargo works so well because they were responsible for the screenplay. So every single line moves the plot forward in Fargo. Here, I think they stay true to the Cormac McCarthy writing, probably just a little bit too much at the end. There's a couple scenes. Barry Corbin plays the brother of Tommy Lee Jones, and there's a scene there where the two brothers sort of wax philosophic a little bit more that you don't find in Fargo. And yeah, I found it just a tad unnecessary, but that's my only quibble with this.
Okay, and that scene I actually love, and I don't know, are they really brothers? I kind of felt like maybe he was his uncle
with
or something.
Yeah,
or
maybe an uncle. I couldn't quite get the
father.
Relationship was.
Yeah, he's a little older, I think, than Tommy Lee Jones's character, but what's interesting, I love that you brought up that scene and the fact that that little detail that Anton Chigurh, this Grim Reaper character, as I said, doesn't engage in this conversation where he basically is going to engage this clerk in a matter of life and death. He's going to make him flip a coin to decide whether or not to kill him, but he isn't going to do it until the guy first invites him into the conversation, because that's his whole thing. And it gets back to this whole thing about free will in this movie and your choices, is that he's not going to be the one to decide your fate. He's going to let you decide your fate. And there are all these little ways throughout the movie that the characters, if you really pay attention to it, as I did the second time around, have to make decisions that they don't want to make. Every little detail comes out. For example, when he goes to a hotel and he says, I need a room. And of course, the woman has to make him pick what room he wants. Do you want one bed? Do you want two beds? What side of the building? He doesn't want to make that choice. And there are so many examples of that throughout the film. And again, these amazing understated performances. I loved everybody here. Josh Brolin, Kelly MacDonald as his wife in a small role. Tommy Lee Jones, I could watch him endlessly in this film. And of course, Javier Bardem, where he's so subtle. His character, you know, with that haircut, it's blatantly comical. And most of the things he says are hysterical, and yet he's so stoic and steely-eyed
and scary.
He's
so grounded in reality. That's the other thing.
It's exactly right. He's peculiar, but he never, you know, makes you really laugh at him. Because you never know what's coming next.
No. I mean, he is a boogeyman, but he is a real-life boogeyman. And I just absolutely love it. I think he is the most menacing figure caught on screen in over 20 years.
Yeah.
I really do. I love his performance that much.
I think it is also that good. I agree completely. And I just want to mention, how great is the scene where Tommy Lee Jones and his deputy, Garrett Dillahunt, who we saw and was really good in The Assassination of Jesse James. There's this great scene, and I point this out only because I want people to understand that if you're this Coen Brothers fan who can think about these great moments, some of the ones we're going to talk about at the end of the show, these really funny, quirky kind of moments, they're still here in this film.
Oh, yeah.
The scene where Tommy Lee Jones and his deputy go out and are investigating the scene of the crime, and he's the deputy, just like we see the deputy to Marge in Fargo, only this time He's goofy, but he's smart. He knows what he's doing. Unlike that Fargo deputy, he's not like the goober there, but he does have these lines where, for example, he's kind of reenacting how it might have gone down, and he's like, and then they do this, and whoa, differences, mm-hmm. which is such a funny way to think about a shootout, like differences, you know, and then he sees a couple of guys on the ground who are wearing ties, and he says, these guys appear to be managerial, you know, just very funny. There are so many
those
great
are
lines
Coen
like that.
Brother moments, but they don't distract, they add, and I think that's the big thing.
I think we're looking at more than one fracas. Execution here, Wild West over there.
That Mexican brown dough.
Oh, these boys is all swole up. So this was earlier, getting set to trade. Then, whoa, differences. You know, might not even have been no money.
That's possible.
But you don't believe it.
No, probably I don't.
I agree. We obviously love this film and look forward to hearing your thoughts on it. No Country for Old Men is in theaters now and will expand to more screens on the 16th and the 23rd. If you do see it and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you want to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
Time for a quick break. Up next, Adam talks with Josh Brolin about the long-awaited Goonies sequel. Or not. Stay with us.
Where did it all begin? Well, I don't really care. There's plenty of faces along the way who'd be glad to place me there. Was it your fault or just my fault? Well, it don't matter anymore. You carve our names on window panes and leave them scattered.
Welcome back to Film Spotting and our All Coen Brothers All the Time edition of the show. Now, Adam recently had a chance to catch up with No Country for Old Men star Josh Brolin, and it seems to me I've seen a lot of him this fall.
Yes, we have. He's had a pretty amazing year with parts in four pretty prestigious films, and that's where I started our interview. I obviously really want to get into No Country for Old Men. It's a film I've seen twice and think is probably, no, definitely is a masterpiece. But I do want to start out by asking you about the run you've had this year of films with No Country, with American Gangster, with In the Valley of Ayla, and of course First Grindhouse. It's a run I think a lot of actors would probably kill to have for their careers. How rewarding has it been to have these opportunities this year?
Well, I mean, just working with the level of filmmakers that I've been fortunate enough to work with, I'm happy if that's what you're asking. I feel very fortunate that people are actually going to see these films. You know, when I saw No Country for the first time, I was with Javier, and we were both very unsure about how it was going to turn out, whether it was all going to work or not. And, you know, I think that we somehow were able to objectify just because the story was so powerful and really kind of feel the tension and the humor of the story itself. So Javier leaned over to me and he goes, I think we're in a pretty good movie, aren't we? I think so, man. I think so. And now that people are watching it and critics are watching it, and from what I've heard, critics are not only seeing it like yourself one time, but two and three times. I know Roger Ebert saw it three times. You know, you couldn't hope for, you know, for more. But I tell you, one of the greatest things for me, you know, we mentioned the four movies because they're bigger movies, but there was a smaller movie I did called The Dead Girl with Karen Moncrief, which is a film I'm really happy with and very proud of. And I saw Sean Penn in Toronto, and he came up, and he was so kind of unabashedly open. And he was like, wow, dude, I saw The Dead Girl, and I thought you were great, great character and a great filmmaker and a great film. And it's that kind of thing that, you know, where it starts to hit you of like, wow, I'm actually doing some good work. That's cool. And it's affecting somebody, and especially somebody who I respect as much as Sean.
I can take a rap for being bad interviewer because I actually really liked The Dead Girl. We reviewed it on our show and tried to get some word out for it. It was a film I really liked, and you were very good in that movie. I am curious, is there anything in particular you can point to that kind of initiated this run that you've had, or is it just kind of the reward for paying your dues over the years?
I don't really see, I mean, I don't see it as a reward because I've always been working and I've always been very happy working. And I think that I set a precedence at least early on in saying no to things that I really didn't care for, even though I needed the money and all that. And there were a couple of things that I did to put some food on the table. But, you know, I've been very, I don't know. I guess this run, at least recently, I think was instigated more by Robert Rodriguez than anybody. You know, we kind of came up with this character together. We would email each other back and forth. I've known Robert for a long time. And we just had fun creating, you know, obviously he instigated the whole character. He's the one who created it. And then together we kind of, you know, expanded on that. And, you know, I don't know. I know the Coens didn't hire me because I was in the Robert film. And I know that Ridley didn't necessarily hire me because I was in the Coens film. But it's, you know, I did an audition tape for the Coens. I did an audition tape for Ridley, which I think is appropriate. It makes you feel, or at least made me feel, that, you know, at least I worked a little bit for the part. So I felt like I belonged there a little more than if I was just offered it. Not to say that I want to do that, you know, all the time. But it was Robert, I would say, in the beginning. And then now that I've worked with these other people, and not only, you know, is it a nice run, but it's easy working with great filmmakers because it becomes about the work instead of about egos and how do I get the actor to, you know, there's a trust involved in just their level of storytelling.
Well, you mentioned Robert Rodriguez and the audition tape. I was wondering if you would share that story of the audition tape again, because it's a pretty fantastic one. And also, why is it that you fought for this role of Llewellyn Moss? What was it about the character or the story or the filmmakers involved that really drew you to it?
To answer your question about the Coens, I was really into the book. You know, Sam Shepard was the one who turned me on to the book. You know, we were out late one night in Austin, Texas while I was doing Grindhouse, and I don't know, it was probably 4 o'clock in the morning. He was like, man, you got to read this book, you know, and it was incredible. And I read it the next day, and I didn't know that it was being made into a film, and I didn't really look at it. I didn't read it with that in mind. And I wasn't told until later that it was going to be made into a film. And it wasn't that I jumped on it, because I've been in these situations a lot of times where even the filmmaker might want to give me the role, but because of whatever value I had, you know, monetary value from a studio standpoint, it didn't make sense for them. So it's nice to be able to, like David O. Russell, when I did Flirting with Disaster, you know, he fought for me to do that role, and it was a great role, and I was really happy with the way the movie and the character turned out. So at least up until this point, it's taken, you know, filmmakers that don't really listen to executives to pull me into their films, which I'm really grateful for. But anyway, so the story the story with the audition tape is I heard that they were making a movie. I read the script. I didn't even read the script, actually. I knew the book really well. They weren't putting the script out there. I got a couple of scenes from the script, and I asked Robert, who, again, I've known for a long time, I said, would you videotape me? You know, we'll use Marley, who was playing my wife in Grindhouse. Would you videotape me doing a couple of scenes? And he goes, man, why don't we just use the camera that we have, the setup that we have? So we did the audition tape. Robert shot it. Quentin directed me, strangely, but directed me. And we shot it on a $950,000 Genesis camera. And it's probably the best looking audition tape in the history of audition tapes. And I think Robert put music to it. He cut it together. I mean, it's really kind of amazing. I don't think I've seen it. I think I saw it right away first, and then I haven't seen it since then, so I don't really remember what it looks like. But I know I was in the background, and they put Marley in the foreground, I guess because they preferred Marley or something. Anyway, we sent it to the Coens, and the Coens, basically, their response was, who lit it? You know, they were very taken with how beautiful the audition tape was, but they didn't respond to me in the least. So they passed, and I have a very persistent agent who called them and just said, just meet him. And I ended up meeting them for their last casting session, and I know that they had a couple of other people in mind, and I think that they were meeting me just as a favor or to get my agent off their back. And the meeting turned out well.
Did you have rehearsal time on the film, and do you like having rehearsal time on movies?
Yeah, I mean, again, going back to David O. Russell's film, we had 3 weeks of rehearsal in his small apartment with, like, me and Mary Tyler Moore and George Siegel and Alan Alda and Ben Stiller and all these amazing people. And I know it brings people together, and it allows people to feel better about humiliating yourself in front of the camera. in order to get the better moments, you know, embarrassing yourself fully. Lily Tomlin was amazing. But, yeah, I like to rehearse. And the Coen, you know, the Coens, the brothers and I and Javier, we rehearsed quite a bit. It was more about questions that we had just about the character and the story and the structure than actually about figuring, because there's not a lot of dialogue in the film, so we didn't really have to delve into that too much. But I'd broken my collarbone 2 days after I found out that I got the role. I hit a car with my motorcycle, so I snapped my collarbone in half. So I was more caught up in my collarbone than I was in rehearsing with them together. I tried to lend myself to it as much as I could, but the collarbone did most of the work.
Coen brothers are obviously known for having a really distinct vision and style. When you're on the set about to shoot, how much of it is really mapped out and how much room is there for spontaneity?
Most of it's mapped out. And J. Todd Anderson, who is their storyboard artist, who, he basically draws, all their very specific vision of what they're going to shoot. So between them and Roger Deakins and all that, they know pretty much exactly what angles they're going for. And then within that, whatever improvisation you want to go for, they're willing to play with at least a little bit. But then again, with this movie, it was more about, talking about how we want to manifest certain ideas without using dialogue. So that was more, should Llewellyn talk to himself again in this scene? Is he going to seem crazy if he talks to himself too much? The fact that there's no music, that the majority of the music or, is really sound design, ambient sound design, and, inhales and what you do with your fingers, how you stand, how you grunt, at least in Llewellyn's, thing. When he finds the money, he goes, mm-hmm, like that. And that we actually talked about that. We actually rehearsed different grunts. So it's funny working with them in that way, but it was a really interesting challenge to be able to, manifest ideas, like I said, through body language and through other means other than dialogue.
Hello?
Yes.
Is Carson Wells there?
Not in the sense that you mean.
You need to come see me.
Who is this? You know who it is. You need to talk to me.
Talk to you.
I think you do.
The silence certainly, as a viewer, draws your attention to every little detail. We do notice all those grunts and all those sounds. You've said that this character was 180 degrees different than you. How is Llewellyn different from you?
Well, it wouldn't be much of an interview if I was Llewellyn, I mean, he doesn't give up a lot, And I think with me, I love dialogue. I love the language. I always have, and it's something that has always been the great challenge for me in doing theater and all that, is really wrapping yourself around verbose, characters. Whereas this is kind of the opposite, And I did American Gangster after that, which is a completely, just diametrically opposed, awful human being who has no integrity whatsoever and, all greed and feeling of invincibility, who ends up, his demise is very telling, Whereas Llewellyn has a ton of integrity and a ton of principle. As much as Chigurh does about his work, I think Llewellyn does about his, love of his wife and his loyalty to his wife.
And speaking of Chigurh, I got into an elevator in Toronto with Javier Bardem, and thank God he didn't have the haircut, because otherwise I'm sure I would have been terrified. I think he might be one of the scariest characters in the history of cinema. Would you agree with that, and why do you think he's so effective in this performance?
I mean, in the performance, I think Javier is fantastic, and I think that he took a huge risk in doing what he did. The thing is what, to me, what Javier brings to a character like this, which you've never seen, is this kind of Spanish openness that he can't get away from. You can't help but lend yourself to who he is, and you can't help but like him. So there's a part of Chigurh, I think, at least from an audience standpoint, from my standpoint as an audience member watching the film, I go, I can't hate the guy. I can't put him, even though there's a status that he kind of creates for himself that's like mythological, there's a humanity, an openness and a humanity to him that creates the mystery and makes you want to follow him wherever he goes. And I think the same goes with both of them. Again, on opposite ends of the spectrum. You have a very human, very innocent, open character on Llewellyn's part, and then you have this other guy who's literally the Grim Reaper manifest, you know.
Well, again, I really loved the film, and I loved your performance. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, too.
That was my conversation with Josh Brolin, who, again, really does fantastic work in No Country for Old Men. I also wanted to mention that writer-director Todd Haynes will be our next guest here on Film Spotting, of course, to discuss his new experimental Bob Dylan biopic, I'm Not There.
Look for that interview and review Wednesday, November 21st. Okay, time for another quick break. When we come back, your feedback on American Gangster, our top five me-decade movies, and Adam's unbearable whiteness of being. Stay with us. Gassinets. She works without a net. I like her better when she walks away. She said she was mine. She told me twice. I like her better when she walks away. Yeah.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD coming out this Tuesday. Another edition of It's a Wonderful Life with some extra features will be out this week. Also, Killer of Sheep with commentary by Charles Burnett. And I wanted to include this, Maddie, because Charles Burnett is one of those filmmakers who I know absolutely nothing about and I know is very revered. And so he's a filmmaker I definitely want to check out. Glad to see Killer of Sheep out now. Ocean's 13, also a bare-bones edition of this film. We sort of liked it here on Film Spotting. Actually, I sort of liked it. Sam really liked it because he's a Soderbergh freak. Where did you fall in Ocean's 13? Did you even see it?
No, I couldn't stand it.
Really?
I didn't think there was 1 ounce of tension in the entire film. I mean, do you honestly think they weren't going to pull off the bank heist?
But you don't think that about Ocean's 11 either, and that film still works.
Yeah, well, this one didn't.
No, it doesn't work. Maybe the disc that has the most interest to our listeners, Maddie, Pride and Prejudice out, the Joe Wright film, in a two-disc gift set. It does include an audio commentary with the director. Paris Jatem also out, a movie reviewed here on Film Spotting favorably. And from the Do We Really Need This file, the Princess Bride 20th Anniversary Edition. I love The Princess Bride, but I feel like they release a new version of this film every year. So I haven't really dived into the extra features yet to see if this version is really worth buying. But we will see. Also, Shrek the Third is out. And also, This is England, a film from earlier this year. I know it deals with skinheads in Britain, obviously.
Yeah,
and it's
pretty
a film
highly regarded, actually.
We're both really looking forward to checking out. I think you actually have it
coming. I have it
coming
at home, yeah.
From Netflix. But yeah, it is a film we're both excited to check out. That is what is new on DVD. Maddie, let's thank our listeners who were so generous as to go to the filmspotting.net site and throw a few bucks our way in support of the show.
All right, this week we want to thank Kevin. I don't have to apologize. You just have to stop crying. A.K.A. ex-Film Spotting host Sam Van Halgren and I have the same birthday. Michael, I got a song to sing about getting drunk again. He's a Silver Club member. Andrew Bad Touch and Andrew Caught Cheating at Bingo Again. That's Andrew S. Brooks Hot Corner. That's a Silver Club member. Ivar, the K is for knitting. Another Silver Club member. And Plants HTML Manipulator. Thank you to each and every one of you.
Yes, thank you to all of our new donors and also to our repeat donors, the monthly subscribers. We do appreciate every penny.
Now, I did have a question this week. I got an email.
Mm-hmm.
If someone already had donated and got a nickname, can they donate again and get another nickname?
Yes, they can. We've had many repeat customers who, for whatever reason, we'll blame it on Sam, want a new nickname. We're happy to give you one.
We're so accommodating.
Mm-hmm.
I love the sun when it's silhouettes. I like her better when she walks away.
It's a fact. It's the greatest city in the history of mankind. Discovered by the Germans in 1904, they named it San Diego, which, of course, in German means a whale's vagina.
Hmm. No, there's no way that's correct.
I'm sorry, I was trying to impress you.
Oh.
I don't know what it means.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. I'm Maddie. He's Adam. It's time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, the listener, get a chance at winning a free DVD. Now, last week, in correlation with our top five movies about the 70s but not made in the 70s, we massacred the not-so-beloved, as it turns out, Anchorman.
Yeah, in fairness, most of our listeners seem to be a fan of the film, but a lot of people did take this opportunity to point out that the movie and or Will Ferrell is apparently overrated.
Well,
news to me.
It's funny because Sam and I saw this movie, of course, together when it first came out, and my girlfriend at the time, for whatever reason, had gone to the same movie. She came later and sat about 10 rows behind us, and she absolutely hated the film, but she just loved watching me and Sam crack up at basically anything that Will Ferrell did on screen.
Yeah, and I do think that even if the movie maybe doesn't hold up or stand as a whole, just individual scenes and moments like the one we did last week for Massacre Theater are so brilliant. I can't believe some people have a problem with this film, but as expected, we thought it would be maybe the easiest Massacre Theater ever, and it was one of the most entered Massacre Theaters ever, but not the number one. I think it's actually number three or number two, but it did obviously make the top five. So a very popular choice there, I guess, last week.
All right, well, reach into the film spotting hat and please pick out a winner.
And the winner is Amanda Herford from Fortville, Indiana. Congratulations, Amanda. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Oh, yeah, makes perfect sense, Nick. I just, I haven't found it yet. I'll get it, though.
Okay, what about you, Chet?
I'm there, man. I'm there. I got the dam bursting, the river, everything. You watch. Changing the blockings really can open things up for me.
Moving on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, a much heated debate here on whether or not this was the right choice for Massacre Theater. It does tie in with the theme of this show, the Coen brothers. And Maddie, I did kind of push this film because...
You're a bully. A lot of people don't know how much of a bully you are.
Mm-hmm.
I never, ever get to choose.
You don't.
You always make poor choices. Oh, my God.
You make poor choices.
This is a good one?
No.
You think this is a good one?
Not necessarily, but I do think it's clever, and I do think it's hard. And that's why I wanted to do it, because following up Anchorman, I wanted to do something that would really pose a challenge. And I predict this week... the fewest entries ever. Not that that's something we normally shoot for, but I think this will actually be the lowest entered Massacre Theater ever. So I'm throwing down the glove to our listeners.
All right.
Okay.
Well, this is under protest.
Fair enough. And just like in baseball, things being under protest means nothing. Let's go ahead and kick it off. Maddie, you start it, so I'll give you the action. And action.
We need a plan.
Let's play dead. Come on, super spy. Think of something.
You're the diplomat. Talk to them.
All right, stop right there, and I'll bring back the sun. Okay, this is my sister. You can all have her. I hear she's very good.
Just take another step, and I start swinging.
You hear that? He's threatening you. Let's get him.
For God's sake, show some balls.
I think it's too late to try and impress them.
And scene.
All right, if you know what film...
One of the 27 people that know what film that is.
It might be 27 that know what film Maddie and I just massacred. Send us an email with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, November 14th. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's podcast. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
This is Robert from Alexandria, Virginia. Longtime listener, first-time caller. I just wanted to say that your most recent episode was fantastic, inspired with the 70s movies not made in the 70s. And I wanted to thank you for heaping praise on Munich, finally, since it is a fantastic movie. I thought it was the best one that came out that year. But I was wondering, what about Summer of Sam? I thought that was a really excellent movie.
This is Jacques from Ossining, New York. So I listened to your review of American Gangster about 30 minutes after seeing the film. And I have to say, I actually agree with you guys on this, especially Maddie. He's been hating lately. I think, though, the problem is not Denzel. The problem is the producer, Brian Grazer. You got to cut this guy out, man. He put together all these people for the wrong film. You got too many Hollywood, quote-unquote Hollywood stars in a movie that should be about the story, not the stars. T.I., Common, RZA? I mean, come on!
Hi, Adam and Matt. It's Eve calling from Brooklyn, New York. In your American Gangster review, I just have to clarify something. I'm sure it was just a mistake, but you do not pronounce RZA of the Wu-Tang Clan, RZA. It's RZA. RZA. RZA can also be seen in Jim Jarmusch's Ghost Dog with Forest Whitaker.
Nice to hear Jacques there agreeing with our take, more or less, on American Gangster. We're going to hear from some listeners here in a moment who definitely disagreed with us. And then also, of course, we have to start out this segment, Maddie, by referencing Eve's voicemail there. Folks were killing me this week for
I'm so glad it was you and not me.
My Hank Kingsley moment there in showing my whiteness. It really was sad in my lack of pop culture acumen. I have to admit, I really did know it was RZA. I mean, I've heard that before many times, but obviously I am not down enough with Wu-Tang to have seen it on paper and immediately know how to say it. And it is really embarrassing. But I mentioned Hank Kingsley, which is a reference to the Larry Sanders Show, which is also probably a very white show. But I want to play this clip, Maddie, because the first thing I thought of when that first email came in saying, Adam, you have no more street cred, as if I had some to begin with, I thought of Hank Kingsley in this bit from the Larry Sanders Show. This is a great moment with the Wu-Tang Clan. You'll actually hear RZA in this scene. Let's go ahead and hear a quick clip.
Hey, where's the dirty old bitch?
Old dirty bastard.
Get it straight, man.
Where is she? You know, he just got out of jail. You know what I mean? He's just holding down at home for a while. Man, see, I know that. I know that dig. You know, I got parking tickets coming right out of my ass.
So there you have it, Jeffrey Tambor trying to fit in with the Wu-Tang Clan. That's about how I would be trying to fit in with the Wu-Tang Clan. And you can watch that entire awkward scene on YouTube. We'll put the clip to it in the notes for this show. But anyway, Alex here off the top, not happy with our review of American Gangster.
No, he says, Adam and Maddie, you really must tell me, how on earth did you get a hold of that infamous blue magic? It really must be as pure as Frank Lucas promised, because you guys were obviously high out of your minds when you saw American Gangster. It's probably my favorite film of the year, and although I can't speak as to why you weren't compelled by it, I found all your criticisms trivial. Sure, not all of the scenes reveal something new about one of the characters, but they don't have to. The momentum builds so steadily, and the main characters are so complex that just watching the performances of Crow and Washington tell you everything you need to know.
Alex Kefalos in Hudson, Ohio there with that rebuke. And Maddie, I don't think he's completely off. I actually do think that there is some momentum to it. I think the characters are really complex, and I love Crow and Washington. For me, this was really a case of a film that I guess I expected greatness from and instead got just good. And
yeah, it wasn't even so much expecting greatness, mm-hmm. but just disappointment. And there wasn't more there. I mean, I thought it was fine on the surface.
Alex there disagreeing with us, as did Matt in Brooklyn, New York. He disagrees vehemently with our review of American Gangster. Sure, the film feels derivative and has its faults, but I feel it does a phenomenal job of showing a new point of view in a well-worn genre. Style over substance? Methinks not. It's not a glamorous shoot-em-up by any means. It doesn't glorify this lifestyle the way De Palma did in Scarface or did again with The Untouchables. We're not subjected to swelling musical cues over palatial estates with jacuzzis and champagne. I feel Scott and Steven Zellian made a great point about the American business mentality and the risks that today's million-dollar businessmen so boldly boast about. The scene where Denzel chastises Cuba Gooding Jr. and goes so far as to compare himself to General Mills was brilliant. He doesn't threaten or swear profusely like De Niro's Capone, but instead accuses a rival gangster of copyright infringement. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. That from Matt in Brooklyn, New York. I actually do agree. I loved that scene, and I love the fact that he did actually talk about his trademark of blue magic. It is something we haven't seen in a drug movie before. That really did work. But the part where I think we disagree with him, Maddie, is although it's true, he doesn't glamorize Frank Lucas the way De Palma does exactly.
Oh, I think he does.
With those films.
Oh, I think
well,
he does.
But in terms of not the palatial estates, really, I mean, he does have that nice house that he gives to his mom, but it isn't the jacuzzis and champagne and fast lifestyle. That's true. But as we pointed out, in choosing to not show at all, except for those really manipulative brief flashes, the degradation caused by Frank Lucas and the real damage he causes, he does, in essence, glorify that lifestyle.
You know, we also got a voicemail, but it was too long to play. We have to give some props to Cleveland from Brooklyn
yes.
as well. We got a whole borough
I
against
guess so.
Us. Ouch.
Yeah, it really was a great voicemail, but Cleveland is always long-winded. We can never fit in his voicemails, unfortunately. So anyway, some thoughts there on American Gangster. Obviously, there were a couple people like Jacques, who we heard from in the voicemail, who did agree with us that there were problems with the film, but many more people who really did love this movie.
Overwhelmingly people writing in saying that they love this film.
Yeah, again, I would say I liked the movie and that I do recommend it. I just did expect more from it and was disappointed. So let's move on then, Maddie, to the top five from last week and some feedback there. Let's start with this one from Eric Munn in Chicago with his top five mid-decade movies, though right off the bat, he's going to get some grief from us.
Yeah, he says, number five, The Last Waltz. This great documentary from Scorsese really captured the music from the 70s that, as the title shows, was on its way out. Well, yeah, because I think it was made in 1976.
78, actually, yeah. So, but it is a 70s movie, obviously exempt
right.
from
but
the rest.
But I would actually say that it shows the end of the 1960s. I think the 60s really stretches from, what, 1963 to about 1976 with the final fall of Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And it is really sort of a coda of sort of a goodbye to that music.
Yeah, I think that's a great point.
All right, number four, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I know Adam mentioned the drugs and free love aspect of the 70s didn't make the top five of your list, but this movie covers much more than that. The look into journalism at the time, the problems of drug use and politics are all touched upon in this great story. Read the book. Read mm-hmm. the book. Don't see the movie.
Okay, ouch.
Number three, Forrest Gump. I know I could get a lot of flack for this, but I love this film. As someone younger, not from the me decade, this film touches on a lot going on in the 70s, including race, drug, and war issues. I like Forrest Gump.
I like Forrest Gump as well.
Number two, Blow. Number one, Good Morning Vietnam, a stellar performance from Robin Williams. How can you have a top five about the 70s and not include something with Vietnam?
That's a good point, and it is a good film. I like that Barry Levinson movie. Blow, the Ted Demme film, not a big fan of that movie.
Is that
maybe
the Johnny Depp one?
Yeah, maybe it's Johnny Depp related there, but a good list there from Eric. This one, Maddie, from Andrew, takes issue with your claim that everyone brings their A game to Dazed and Confused. He says, I love Dazed and Confused and generally agree with Maddie's statement, but in my humble opinion, the movie features one of the single worst performances in recent cinema history. Wiley Wiggins is so bad as Mitch Kramer that his performance actually makes me laugh every time he makes those funny faces when he is trying to act embarrassed. Strangely, I find this performance to actually increase my enjoyment of the film. There is something about a so bad it's good performance mixed in with an otherwise excellent film that somehow works for me. I agree, it kind of works on that level. Wiley Wiggins is terrible in that movie, and in fact, I'm rubbing the bridge of my nose right now as he does 4,000 times, so everyone listening can take a drink.
Exactly. And I had it in my notes, actually, to comment on Wiley Wiggins, but in the top five,
it's all about love.
Yeah. Film spotting.
It is.
Wayne Willens says, okay, Adam, you promised that you would explain why Boogie Nights didn't make the list, but you never did. Goodfellas is in the Pantheon. No, I believe the majority of it takes place in the 70s. Summer of Sam would be on my list. I lived that summer, guys, and sure, it's Spike at his hyperbolic best or worst, I guess, but it's still pretty damn accurate in recreating the era. Interesting, too, is that the subject matter relates well to the fear factor you discussed in your analysis of The Seventh Seal.
Great point.
Did either of you mention Almost Famous, Adam? If not, then what the... Also, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind and Autofocus, please discuss.
Wayne in the DC Burbs there. A great email because it is true. I said at the outset of the top five that I was going to mention my alternative list, the obvious 70s movies, right. The ones about hedonism.
And it got lost in post-production or
something? It did something. I managed just to completely forget to say that in getting caught up in my whole obsessive quest idea. But it is true. Goodfellas, first of all, is in the Pantheon, so we couldn't include that. But Boogie Nights, Almost Famous, Dazed and Confused, and Drugstore Cowboy, a movie we'll hear about here in a second, those would have been my four for sure no-brainer mid-decade movies. And I just thought, does anyone really want to listen to me talk about Almost Famous again? I kind of feel like, especially longtime listeners know at this point, it's a film I love. Same with Boogie Nights, same with Dazed and Confused. So I went another route, but it is true. Guys like Paul in Ontario, Canada wrote in and said, how could your number one 70s movie not be Almost Famous? But that does bring us here. Let's close with this one from our friend Brett Merriman, who does chime in on Drugstore Cowboy.
Right. He says, released in 1989, set in 1971, the most watchable film about drug use bar none, no heebie-jeebies, pitch-perfect performance by Matt Dillon, the only great performances for Kelly Lynch and Heather Graham in their careers, and it even has film spotting favorite James DeGroe. To this day, I never put a hat on the bed. And I have to say, I have never seen the film.
You have not seen Drugstore Cowboy?
I have never seen Drugstore
Cowboy. For shame, Maddie. You need to see it. It is a great film. But he says the only great performance for Kelly Lynch, apparently he hasn't seen a little masterpiece called Curly Sue. Or Roadhouse.
Roadhouse. That's where I was going. I was like, she's in Roadhouse.
She is. Yeah, yeah. She's in both of those films. So thank you, Brett, for that. And also Jared from Dorchester, our friend there in Dorchester, wrote in and said, Drugstore Cowboy, talk about a me movie. There's nothing more me than drug addiction. Not only is Dylan and his crew physically and mentally hooked on farmies, they also become addicted to the game of getting a fix. That's absolutely true. He also had some good choices here. City of God, Bloody Sunday.
Oh, City of God, yes.
I know. I overlooked City of God as well. Bloody Sunday, a movie I love, Paul Greengrass, I thought about, but it's such a small part of the 70s. Yeah. I just felt like it had to be excluded. And then also Carlito's Way, one of the few and last De Palma movies I like. I think Carlito's Way works pretty well.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty fun film.
Okay, well, as always, we appreciate every bit of feedback. If you've got any feedback for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for another quick break. When we come back, a top five list that really ties the podcast together, our top five Coen Brothers movie moments. Please stay with us.
I was drunk. I was down. I was wandering around my bed. I was drunk, I was down, I was wandering around my bed. I called out your name. Call out your name.
Film Spotting's Top 5 is presented by Spout.com. Share your lists, reviews, and discuss movies with your friends for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
Hi, this is Matthew Vaughn. I am the director of Stardust, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Look upon me! I'll show you the life of the mind! Ah! 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 Look upon me!
You are listening to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and a clip there from the Coen Brothers film Barton Fink, John Goodman in the fiery hallway there, and we're playing it because we do feel like it's one of those iconic Coen Brothers moments. You said to me actually earlier today, Maddie, that it's the only scene you really remember from Barton Fink.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I know, and I'm actually the exact same way. So it really does stand out, and it's one we wanted to include there, even though it is not going to make our final top five here for either of us. So that's how good, that's how rock solid our top five lists are, that Barton Fink, the end of Barton Fink, doesn't make the list. Before we get to that top five, though, Maddie, let's check in on our poll questions. And last week's poll question did tie in with the Coen Brothers. We asked you what you thought the best Coen Brothers film was, and the choices were Barton Fink, The Big Lebowski, Fargo, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, Miller's Crossing, and Raising Arizona. How did it come out, Maddie?
Well, pretty overwhelmingly, number one, Fargo at 39%. Number two, The Big Lebowski at 18%. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and third at 15%. Miller's Crossing at 14% in fourth, Raising Arizona in fifth at 11%, and Barton Fink only garnering 4%. Not a big surprise for me. I really thought Fargo was going to win.
Really? I actually did think Big Lebowski would win or be closer than just 18% to Fargo's 39%, but I can't argue with those choices. I was surprised to see, I have to say, even though I liked the film, that Oh Brother, Where Art Thou would finish ahead of Miller's Crossing.
Yeah,
and
I was a little
Arizona,
bit surprised by that, too.
Two movies I like better than Oh Brother, personally. And also, we do have to point out, I know you want me to point out, Maddie, that some listeners did write in and say, how could you have left off Blood Simple? It was an oversight. I actually think Blood Simple is a better film than Oh Brother, for example. So
exactly.
It really did belong on the list.
Exactly.
We do appreciate your feedback on that poll question, which brings us to this week's poll question to digress from the Coen Brothers for just a moment. We want to know how interested you are in the new film Southland Tales, which opens next week. So we're asking you, Richard Kelly's Southland Tales opens November 14th. I am
excited, curious, mildly interested, unenthusiastic, totally oblivious, or I wish Adam would let Maddie pick the movie sometime so we could hear what the guys think about Beowulf, because why in God's name should we care about Southland Tales starring The Rock and Sarah Michelle Gellar? Adam, which are you going to vote for?
Well, you would never guess, but I'm not going with option number six there, Maddie. Sorry, I can't believe how interested you are in Beowulf, and I don't mean to dog it. I'm sorry.
It looks so cool.
I'm not intrigued.
It looks so cool. Angelina Jolie? Zemeckis?
It does nothing for me. It really doesn't do anything for me. I'm sorry. I would be curious to know how many of our listeners would rather have us review Beowulf than the new film from the guy who made Donnie Darko. And you can then, you know, come out and explain how much you hate Donnie Darko here in a moment. But I would be curious to know. I'm guessing more listeners would be with me and they would be more interested in Southland Tales. But we'll find out when they do answer this poll question. Right now, I would say I would come in at curious. I'm not excited. I can't say I'm dying to see it, but I want to see what Richard Kelly is up to after Donnie Darko, and also when there's been this whole production about it finally getting made and being released. So,
yeah, no, I'm actually curious as well. I'm upset that we're not reviewing Beowulf, but I'm still going to go. I'm going to wear my 3D glasses. It's an IMAX.
All right. Have fun. I'm sorry. I will miss that. Let's now get back to the Coen Brothers. I know you love praising your Minnesota brethren.
Oh, yeah.
We decided it would be fun to pay tribute to the Coen brothers by counting down our five favorite Coen brothers scenes or moments, however you want to look at it. Maddie, what was your number five?
Well, I want to step aside for a second. Now, you always give yourself like an advanced placement list challenge.
Yes.
You always seem to take it to the nth degree.
Uh-huh.
So I, just humor me here for a second. I came up with my own top five Big Lebowski moments, so they wouldn't have to be on my top
list.
Five. Yeah, because
Fair
I
enough.
Do absolutely love that film. So I just want to get through them quickly here. My number five, I'm talking about the dude here. The opening shot of the dude in Ralph's writing the check for milk as George Bush declares this aggression will not stand on the television. Number four, stay out of Malibu, deadbeat. Stay out of my beach community. Of course, the police chief of Malibu interrogation scene. Number three, lots of ins, lots of outs. The dude monologue, of course, in the stretch limo. Number two, Liam and me. That's the Jesus Hotel California scene. And number one, you're out of your element. Any dialogue scene in the bowling alley featuring the dude, Donnie, and Walter Sobchak.
So you actually not only have an alternative top five, you have like an alternative top 50.
Exactly.
There. Okay, well, as long as you've got all your bases covered there, I hope you feel better. What is now your official number five?
All right, my number five is the ending of Blood Simple. The great E. Emmett Walsh getting stabbed through the hand, shooting and punching out the wall, and then, of course, laughing as he realizes the absurdity of his situation before the movie ends with a close-up on the dripping faucet. Just a great scene.
It is a great scene. We may end up hearing more about it here in a moment. Damn you, Maddie.
What's your number five?
My number five, though, this one is going to be the one I think that will surprise people because it's from Fargo, a film I loved, a film last week on the show I said before No Country for Old Men came out was my favorite Coen Brothers movie. And there are obviously so many really classic moments and lines that we all think of. This one probably isn't it for a lot of people, but for me, it really does stand out. And I'm going to play just a quick scene of it here. This is my number five scene. It's from the movie Fargo.
Well, what about you, Mike? Are you married? You got kids?
Yeah. I was married. I was married to... You mind if I sit over here? I was married to Linda Cooksey.
No, why don't you sit over there? I prefer that.
Huh? Oh. Okay. Sorry.
Oh, no, just so I can see you. Don't have to turn my neck.
Oh, sure. I understand. I didn't mean to.
No. That's fine.
That's Marge going to the Radisson to talk with her old high school friend, Mike Yanagida.
Yeah,
because
great scene.
That scene really is great. And the reason why it stands out for me when I think about Fargo is because I remember walking out of the theater loving that film and having that scene stick in my mind and wonder what it was doing in the film.
Mm-hmm.
I just did not get what that scene, really bizarre scene, this diversion where he explains that he married this person they knew in high school and she died and he's coming on to her, and I just didn't get it. And I'm like, why is that even in this movie? And the more I thought about it, the more I decided anyway that it's really kind of the key to the film in many ways. I think it's another example of a character in a desperate situation, and he's lonely, and I think the whole film is really about a celebration of like Marge and Norm. The film really is about those two characters and the antithesis to what we see going on with William H. Macy and what he's after in A Happy Life. They truly have this happy life. A lot of people thought it was a movie making fun of these Minnesotans. They're the heroes of the film. And I think that this character, the Mike Yanagida character, is another one who is someone who just wants that kind of happiness that Marge has.
It also showcases the only time in the film that Marge is vulnerable. So that's why I think it's in there.
That's a great point.
All right, well, my number four is from the same film, and actually it's the opening and closing scenes of Fargo. I get goosebumps every time Carter Burwell's score swells as the burnt Sierra in the first scene and the ambulances and police cars in the last frame drive down just the snow-swept highway. It's so desolate and beautiful, and you ask yourself, my God, where am I? And then at the same time, you know exactly where you are and what you're getting into. It still gives me goosebumps just thinking about it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Well, I'm not even going to try to do the Jeff Bridges here. I can't do it, but the whole thing where he's saying, I've got information, man.
It's just beautiful.
It's come to light. New information's come to light. And just watching him, the way the Coen brothers do that scene, it's so hilarious. And Jeff Bridges is so hilarious. But the Coen brothers only cut to the other two people listening to the dude when he finishes what he's saying when they absolutely have to. We never get any reactions. It's like the camera's just lingering on him, letting him hang himself. Oh. And so you just wait and watch and just can't imagine what they must be thinking. And then we get those great reaction shots and those great responses. But that scene is just comedic brilliance.
I'm going to go home and watch it tonight. You got me so excited about it. All right, my number three, I'm not really going to talk much about it because I bet it's going to make your list, and that's the Huggies chase scene in Raising Arizona. I think it's on par with the Blues Brothers chase scene through the mall as one of the best captured on film.
That's a great comparison there. It is a great pick. My number three, you actually had it, is your number five. I didn't think we'd have this much overlap, Maddie, but we do. It's the end of Blood Simple, though I would maybe pick out a little bit different part of it. It's the way that film really uses silence, and it's not so much like the stabbing of M. Emmett Walsh, but the scene where after she's slammed the window down on his hands and then drives the knife through his hand into the windowsill, he screams, and then all of a sudden there's this silence, yeah. And then he shoots the gun, the holes through the wall, and I just remember those holes coming through in the light, and then he punches through the wall and removes the knife, and I've seen this movie a couple of times, and every time I jump in that moment, because again, he's so frightening. He's such a sleazy snake of a character, M. Emmett Walsh, and you just don't know what he's really capable of, and that burst of the gunshot and the lighting there in that scene, it's just fantastic. So I have the end of Blood Simple as well.
Yeah, and if I'm going to equate their success in No Country for Old Men to one of their other films, I think it most closely resembles Blood Simple.
I agree.
And my number two is actually from No Country for Old Men. It's the hotel hallway scene.
Oh, wow.
Josh Brolin on one side of the door, Javier Bardem on the other. I guarantee you will know which one I'm talking about. I won't say any more.
No, you want to talk about tension in that scene.
Brilliant.
It's unbelievable, and there are many scenes like that in the movie. Great choice there. I tried to leave out No Country for Old Men just because at this point it's so fresh in my mind that I'd pick 10 or 12 different scenes. So I left it out, but that's a great choice by you. My number two is Miller's Crossing, the look into your heart scene, which I want to say maybe Sam and I actually did as a Massacre Theater scene.
Oh, I'd love to hear that one.
I can't remember. I feel like we did. But this for me is one of those classic, just like John Goodman in The Fiery Hallway, I'm always going to think of Tom, Gabriel Byrne, just staring expressionless at John Turturro as he's weaseling his way through the forest trying to talk his way out of getting killed. It's just intense. And again, the way the camera cuts between them and the way Gabriel Byrne never relents, I just remember feeling like, what is he going to do in the scene? And as annoying, and as much as I thought John Turturro's character deserved it, all that begging, I'm praying, you know, look into your heart. You want almost that Gabriel Byrne won't kill him, that Tom won't shoot him. So it's a really fantastic scene for me. Again, when I think of the Coen brothers, it obviously is one of the first couple that pop into my head.
That's a great pick. And of course, my number one is from the same film, and that's the Danny Boy shootout in Miller's Crossing. I think probably the most gorgeously crafted 6 minutes of violence ever captured on screen. I just love it. Albert Finney, it's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Miller's Crossing, I have to admit, is a film I haven't seen in probably 10 years and really want to go back and check out. My number one, let's play a clip.
Wake up, son. I'll be taking these Huggies and whatever cash you got.
I'll be taking these Huggies.
I'll just be taking these Huggies here, whatever cash you got. Yes, Maddie, you were right. It is my number one, the diaper robbery sequence from Raising Arizona. And what's so great about it is the way it starts out with him saying, Nathan needs some Huggies. I'll be out directly. And then he goes in and he picks up the pantyhose. He steals the pantyhose so he can put them over his head. And the way the camera then goes from the license plate of the car, this is one of those great Coen brothers kind of stealing Sam Raimi, Evil Dead. They work together. And we see it in Blood Simple too. The shot where the camera's low, they kind of used to put the camera on like a board, a piece of wood, and they started out low on the license plate, and then she peels out and leaves him, and the camera then rushes up to his face. It's a great shot, and then you really do. I mean, you talk about the Blues Brothers. I think it's way better.
Oh, it's
you
better,
get this
yeah.
tremendous orchestration of just madcap kind of Keystone Cops behavior with High running through houses, running through other supermarkets, getting shot at, and then still somehow ending up running out of another building and jumping into the car with Edwina. It's really masterful stuff, and it's one of those things that, again, shows you just how great these two filmmakers are, the Coen brothers are, because it's a comedic sequence that is really funny that you could have seen that same setup in another movie, in the same movie with that same kind of sense of humor, but it never would have been orchestrated with that much skill if it wasn't the Coen brothers.
Well,
it's my number one.
Brilliant, brilliant pick. All right. Well, those are our top five Coen Brothers scenes. Send your list or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voice message.
Opening wide this weekend, Fred Claus with Vince Vaughn and Paul Giamatti, the new horror movie P2, and, of course, No Country for Old Men, which we can't tell you to run to fast enough.
See it a couple times.
Yeah, next week on the show, we will review Southland Tales, the new Richard Kelly film, and maybe Lion for Lambs.
Or maybe Beowulf.
Or maybe Beowulf. Listen, I want to make it clear to everyone. I told Maddie he's got carte blanche to come on the show, and if he wants to go ahead and spend 3 minutes talking about it, the forum is yours. But I don't want to see it.
Thanks,
and Maddie
Adam.
Stays silent. We're also planning to discuss the next film in our Bergman Marathon, Wild Strawberries. I know we had promised that for this week.
What
but
could be a better coupling? Wild Strawberries and Beowulf.
I know. You're right. It is a perfect combination. But again, Lions for Lambs, the Redford film, we might talk about it. We might not. I haven't read any reviews, but I know it's kind of getting panned. So maybe we'll touch on it. And our top five is still up for grabs, so feel free to send any suggestions our way. We can't really do sci-fi movies. We've done that on the show. We've also done sophomore efforts, with this being, you know, Richard Kelly's follow-up to Donnie Darko. So I don't know where we're going yet. Again, feedback@filmspotting.net if you've got any great ideas.
Okay. Thanks to Alex and Angela on our message boards, Frank Huckle and Candace Griffiths. Thanks also to Alejandro Escovedo for this week's music. Learn more at bloodshotrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode.
I know Andy.
Yeah, he called me Andy.
Should I read
Did
that?
Did you see someone last week who said Maddie and Scott?
I like Maddie and Scott.
I bet you do.